This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Black unemployment is on the rise. Rural vaccine rates are also on the rise. Lobster prices on the rise. And also complications that arise when Banksy vacations in your town. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, California, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 6th of September. Good, as always, to have you along. Regular listeners to this program will recall that the unemployment report released on Friday showed weaker than expected job growth in August as the Delta variant surged. The overall trend seemed positive. Unemployment fell from 5.4 to 5.2%, but not for Black workers. They were the only racial or ethnic group to see unemployment rise a lot, from 8.2 to nearly 9%. And that trend is going in the wrong direction, just as federal unemployment benefits, which have extended and expanded relief for millions of Americans, expire today. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
The unemployment report did contain one piece of sort of good news for Black workers, says Chandra Childers, a director at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. The number of Black workers in the labor force went up in August after falling the month before.
So they're going back into a labor market, but it's a labor market where the areas where they tend to work are shrinking.
Industries like leisure and hospitality, state and local government, and childcare have been slower to bounce back and are big employers of Black women.
Not only do Black women work in childcare, but they also are more likely than other groups of women to be the sole provider in their households, which means childcare becomes ever more important.
But differences between industries don't fully explain the gap in Black and white unemployment, says William Spriggs, an economist at Howard University and the AFL-CIO. He says it's clear there's discrimination in the labor market.
It screams at you. And the unemployment rate for Blacks with associate degrees was higher than the unemployment rate for whites who were dropouts.
He says Black workers remain unemployed the longest, supporting the adage they are often the first fired, last hired in our economy, which makes the cutoff of federal unemployment programs today all the more concerning, says Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation.
The thing we're trying to prevent is are people pushed into economic situations that can have a long-term family and social effect? Do they lose their home? Do they lose their car?
He says Black workers have been more likely to rely on federal programs, which offered relief to the long-term unemployed, those without traditional full-time jobs, or those who had to leave work due to caretaking or illness. And they're more likely to live in southern states where it can be harder to qualify for unemployment and benefits are lower. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
U.S. markets are closed for the Labor Day holiday. It's also Rosh Hashanah. Happy New Year if you're celebrating. We'll take a look at global markets and some other economic indicators when we do the numbers. We've been hearing an awful lot about how vaccination rates in rural America are way behind rates in urban areas. But on the plus side, those rates have been rising lately. That definitely corresponds with increasing COVID infections and some hospitals in rural areas running out of ICU beds. That, of course, makes the seriousness of the pandemic much more obvious. But there are other better reasons for the uptick. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports on how rural influencers and community organizers are getting their neighbors to roll up their sleeves.
Joyce Barlow started knocking on her neighbors' doors in rural Randolph County, Georgia, earlier this year to talk about the COVID vaccine.
There was still that hesitancy.
Barlow is a registered nurse, and she tries to convince folks that it's safe.
For people to understand and to know and to see that I'm doing fine. I've got my card to show you if you think I'm joking. I've had the vaccination.
In rural Weld County, Colorado, podcaster Chris Garcia appears in social media ads targeting the Spanish-speaking community.
Hazlo por tus padres. Hazlo por tu familia. Get vaccinated.
Patricia Lepiani runs Colorado's Department of Health vaccine outreach campaign and says having local fire chiefs, farmers, and doctors spread the word is important in rural areas.
Because I will trust more someone that is in my community than a person that is living in Denver.
This kind of outreach seems to be one reason why some rural Americans are changing their minds, says Alex Arnon with the Penn Wharton budget model.
There's been a, a sharper uptick recently.
In late August, rural counties saw the largest weekly vaccination increase since mid-July, according to the Center for Rural Strategies. And rural economies have a lot on the line here, says Arnon.
Rural areas are very exposed to some of the indirect effects of the pandemic. So, for instance, oil and gas extraction are really important parts of many rural economies.
And those sectors have been hit hard, he says. Overall, rural vaccinations still lag city rates. Nationwide, as of late August, about 38% of rural residents are fully vaccinated, compared to around half in metro areas. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
In lots of parts of the country, rural or otherwise, this is back to school week. And there is, of course, a lot on the minds of school leaders as kids come back. School safety, COVID testing, debates around masking, how to help kids catch up academically if they've fallen behind, and also food. Because of the labor shortage and widespread supply chain issues, school leaders are worried about how they're going to feed the kids in their cafeterias. Rebecca Klein reports.
In Jefferson County, Colorado, school has already started. Beth Wallace is the Executive Director of Food and Nutrition Services for the district.
We are experiencing things that we have never experienced before. We typically have 450 employees, and our vacancies are currently running at about 98.
She says the district raised the wages of school cafeteria workers from $12.48 an hour to $15 an hour. People still haven't been coming back to work. Figuring out what to serve kids has become a challenge. This year, students will be receiving fewer meal choices.
You know, our high schools may have had six or seven options, and this year they may be lucky to get two of those options. And by the way, whatever we have printed with our menus may have to change on the spot because of delivery of products not arriving.
There's a similar story at Plymouth Canton Schools in Michigan. Kristen Hennessy is the director of food and nutrition services there. She's tried to get creative in recruiting staff. When school employees go to restaurants and meet servers or other workers who seem talented, she's asked them to hand out business cards with a QR code that links to an application with the school district.
Well, there's a labor shortage, of course, like everyone. And that's kind of what I told the staff. I said, we aren't alone in this. Everyone's having to alter how they do business. And so we're not on an island by ourselves.
Nationwide, the School Nutrition Association says public school cafeterias served more than 29 million students before the pandemic. This year, as more of them return to in-person classes, the search for staff to cook and serve meals is a challenge nationwide. Katie Wilson is the executive director of the Urban School Food Alliance, a group that represents food service professionals in the nation's largest school districts.
So the labor shortage has become a really quite a crisis point for many of us in school nutrition, particularly in these large urban districts. Many of our districts are looking for 200 to 300 employees in their school nutrition program alone.
And she says the labor shortage doesn't end at the cafeteria door.
The distributors, the manufacturers are also having labor problems. So there are not enough people working in warehouses. There are not enough truck drivers. We've heard from a couple of the distributors that for every 10 trucks, they can only send one out.
And the shortages, combined with demand, are driving up prices. Wilson says she's heard of school districts where costs have risen anywhere from 7 to 30% this year. Many school districts also have fewer options for cooking food on site.
Buying more local product, processing our own foods and preparing our own foods, that takes labor. It's easy to buy something in a package and heat it up and serve it, but we don't want to do that.
And while food that's prepackaged, cooked offsite, may meet nutritional requirements, she says it won't be as fresh as food cooked at a school. I'm Rebecca Klein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's not rocket science. A brick wall has to breathe.
Okay, yeah, this is news to me. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed for the holidays. Here's a look at where the major indexes stand for the year so far. The Dow Industrials are up about 17%, the NASDAQ up almost 21%, and the S&P 500 up more than 22%. It was a normal trading day in Europe and a return to normal. Traders returned to the London Metal Exchange, where the prices of worldwide metal contracts are set. The trading pit has been closed for 18 months because, you know, COVID. But while we're talking metals, aluminum prices soared to their highest level in a decade today. The apparent reason is a military coup in the mineral-rich West African nation of Guinea that threatens to gum up the global aluminum supply chain, as if the supply chain needed more gum. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. We've talked a lot about how tough it is to buy a home right now, but the cost of renting homes is rising too. I know, it never stops. According to the latest reading from CoreLogic, the cost of renting a single-family home in the U.S. rose faster in June than it has since at least 2005. And if you're looking for a rental in a fast-growing area with lots of people moving in, good luck, because rental vacancies in some places have also fallen to historic lows. This all brings us to the next installment of our series, Adventures in Housing.
I'm Callie Capps. I work at a bathroom remodeling company as an inside sales representative, and I live in Spokane Valley, Washington. About 50 to 55% of my income is going to rent right now. A couple months ago, my landlord told me that I was going to have to move out. She gave me a 30 days notice to move out of the house. I feel like I can't really blame her for selling the house because right now is the seller's market. She's going to make a lot of money on our small house that really isn't worth that much, but she's selling it for over $300,000. I can't hold it against her. I probably would do the same thing, but it was unfortunate for myself at the time. It's like a full-time job. I mean, when you're finding a place to rent, I was on, you know, all the renting websites and Facebook and Craigslist, and then, of course, the Zillow and apartments.com, all of them, to be able to find something. And the key really is to find something first. There's no other way. The line is so long, you know, that you're just not going to even get a chance if you are not in the first couple people. So it took 3 weeks of like heavy searching to even find this place. More expensive than I can afford. I mean, a lot. I literally just paid my whole check plus $100 to pay the rent out of my price range, quite honestly, but it was the absolute only option that we had. One of the reasons why I moved out of California was to go to a place where I could be a single mom and raise a son and not have to struggle check to check. And it's been such a spike in the, you know, cost of rentals that I'm not even sure how I'm going to make it at this point.
Callie Capps there in Spokane Valley, Washington. If you want to tell us about your housing story, you can do that at marketplace.org. A more lighthearted story about higher prices now, not houses, lobster. Yep, lobster prices are higher than ever in New England this summer, thanks to soaring demand with tourists dining out again. That means in some places, a lobster roll, just a roll, not even a whole lobster, will set you back as much as $40. But it doesn't matter. Folks are still willing to line up for a couple hours to get one. At least they are at one lobster shack on the coast of Maine, where even though there's a place across the street with no wait, the line is apparently part of the experience. People are weird. Shannon Mullen went by to check it out.
Picture a roadside shack, bright red, and a line of 40-plus customers stretching down the block and sometimes around the corner. That's Red's Eats on the famous Coastal Route 1 in Wiscasset, Maine, rain or shine, from opening day in spring until it closes in October. Ryan Lewis lives down east in Rockport and got in line with his family after driving past Red's for years.
Whether it took us 2 hours to stay in the line or 30 minutes, it doesn't really matter. We just really wanted to check it off the bucket list.
Farther up the line,
you can start to smell it.
Yeah, a little loopy, a little giddy with excitement. You know, it's almost my turn.
Pennsylvanians Lucas Truckenbrode and Emily Bell heard about Red's on TV.
Do you normally enjoy waiting in line?
Not particularly. I don't seek it out.
Okay, so what is it about this line?
That's a great question. I have never waited in a line this long before for anything. But then it was like almost like I committed, you know, and I have to get to the end.
Red's has changed hands a few times in the 81 years it's been serving lobster rolls from this spot. For the last 30 or so, the shack has literally faced its competition, Sprague's Lobster, across the road on a pier overlooking the Sheepscot River. So customers waiting at Red's can see it and how much shorter the line is. New Yorker Isabel Sung wondered how Sprague stays in business.
Like, they probably get the leftovers from this place.
Not so, says owner Frank Sprague.
We get up to 20, 30, but it happens quicker here.
Sprague says he has more kitchen space than Red's, so the wait stays under an hour.
I would say we're sharing basically the same customer base. Some of them end up coming down here. And
wait, what do they say when they come down here?
What's the deal with that line? A lot of people like standing in line.
Massachusetts native Paul Lang saw the line at Red's and came to Sprague's.
To me, the dynamic over there is that there's a line and there's always a wait, and the perception is there's like Oz at the end of the wait, and it's just like, no, it's lobster on a roll.
The rolls are usually cheaper at Sprague's, depending on market price. $30 the day I went, $36 at Red's. But Red's claims to put more than a whole lobster in every roll, and that it serves a season total of 14 and a half tons. Sprague's figures he sells half that, not counting thousands of lobster dinners, not on the menu across the road. Red's serves free popcorn shrimp while you wait, and has a posted list of celebrities who've stood in line. Sprague's plays Blues and Zydeco from loudspeakers, and offers a free lunch to anyone who arrives on water skis. Locals line up at both. Bucky Holloway from Southport says he's a regular at Sprague's.
We've bought 20 people here. When my mom died, we put her ashes on the river, and we all came here and chowed down, and it was nice.
Nicole Pelletier grew up in nearby Farmingdale and just tried Red's for the first time.
It's not like any other lobster rolls that we usually have around here, because it's just like completely stuffed beyond the brim. So it's definitely worth the wait.
Some say Sprague's feels and smells more like Maine, especially at low tide. Others fly in from as far as Delaware just to go to Red's. Rick Tetrov manages the Wiscasset Regional Airport. He says each week at least a few planes land with folks who also have to rent a car for the 4-mile drive to Red's.
That's a phenomenon. That's for darn sure.
Tetrov says some of them give up on the line and head across the road.
They thought that Sprague's was really good.
Both shacks are family businesses, and Sprague says they're on friendly terms. The current owner of Red's was too busy for an interview, but said by email that there's enough sunshine for everyone to get a tan. In Wiscasset, Maine, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Speaking of summer vacation, what happens when a famous artist decides to have a little staycation at the English seaside that turns into a bit of a working vacation? The artist in question is the secretive graffiti master Banksy, who's apparently been peppering small towns along Britain's east coast with new work. Great! Sort of. The art is bringing in new tourists and their money, but preserving the works is a challenge for cash-strapped local councils. The BBC's Vishala Sripathma reports.
With its long golden beach, Great Yarmouth was once the top destination for a British seaside holiday. The town was also rich from a fishing industry dating back to Roman times. But the boats filled with silver herring are long gone, and Great Yarmouth's economic fortunes have slowly declined, with a quarter of its neighbourhoods now among the most deprived in England. Its outlook dramatically changed this summer, though, thanks to the mysterious graffiti artist, Banksy.
Just before the weather, the big question tonight is Banksy in the region?
A mural of an elderly couple dancing atop a bus shelter was the first of at least 10 pieces that suddenly appeared along the east coast of England last month. Banksy confirmed the pieces were by him in this online video called The Great British Spraycation. Other paintings include a giant seagull eating from a recycling dumpster and a rat lounging in a deck chair while drinking a cocktail on the beach. Banksy, who keeps his identity top secret, is considered one of the world's top living artists, and his work sells for millions of dollars. And some locals are cashing in. The mural of a young girl using a crowbar to make a sandcastle was painted on the side of an office building that was up for sale for $400,000. But as curious tourists kept arriving, the property owner realised the Banksy mural might be worth more than the building and has taken it off the market. Carl Smith is the leader of the Great Yarmouth City Council, which is trying to protect the artworks.
The big thing was, as soon as we knew they were genuine Banksys, that we needed to put security in place. So we had 24-hour security guards, and then we have now covered them with a plastic screening. I haven't got a figure on the cost, but obviously the cost is immaterial, really. You know, we have to make sure these are secure and obviously, as I said, you know, preserved for future, for people to come and see. You know, they've certainly caused a stir.
But living with a Banksy painting has also thrown up some unexpected costs. John Brandner is an art dealer specialising in Banksy's work. He paid six figures for a piece earlier this year.
The one I bought in Nottingham, the council had put Perspex over it, and it has cost me tens of thousands of pounds to undo the damage they did. So you get a microclimate behind the Perspex, mould gets in there, and it eats the paint. It's not rocket science. A brick wall has to breathe.
Back in Great Yarmouth, locals are celebrating the news. They've made the shortlist to become the UK's City of Culture in 2025 after receiving a so-called Banksy boost. After a tough 18 months of lockdowns, the timings couldn't be better, because even as the summer winds down here, the Banksy Spraycation Tour will continue to attract visitors even when the beaches are closed come winter. I'm the BBC's Vishala Sripathma for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, it may be Labor Day weekend and the end of summer. It may be the official start of back to school season. It may even be pumpkin spice latte season already. But you know what it doesn't need to be? Halloween season. I literally saw a big pumpkin display at a store this weekend, not to mention all the candy. I'm not buying a pumpkin while it's still 90 degrees, people. So thank you, Ad Week Morning Consult poll out today, that says 60% of respondents do not need to see Halloween decorations until the end of September. And about the same, 60%, said putting them out in late August, which is what has been happening, is just, and I'm liberally paraphrasing here, unacceptable. All right, we got to go, but not without your moment of economic context. Here's something you don't hear every day. The CEO of one of the world's biggest port operators, Maersk-owned APM Terminals, says the only way to get out of the supply chain crisis that's driving up prices and leaving store shelves empty is for consumers, especially American consumers, to buy less. How's that for the start of the holiday season? Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.